medical devices, and combination products. The healthcare industry is increasingly embracing the opportunities offered by medical devices, in vitro diagnostic combination products, and health information technology. This theme examines the trends in this rapidly evolving field and examines the regulatory challenges posed by these novel combination therapies, particularly the use of the biologics used in drug-device combinations. It also considers the regulatory aspects of how information technology and health apps collect and use the data generated by modern medical devices. How can we ensure that we have a regulatory environment capable of reacting quickly to the needs of this dynamic sector and maximizing its benefits for the patient? The theme also provides the latest news on the upcoming European medical device regulation and in vitro diagnostic regulation, and highlights the latest trends in international medical device regulation and analyzes consequences for the future. Hello, I am Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Editor for DIA's Global Forum magazine. I'm here with Paul Janssen, Global Head of Medical Devices for the U.S. for Sanofi, and with Sabine Hoekstra van den Bosch, Global Regulations and Standards, Philips Healthcare, the Netherlands. Paul and Sabine are co-leads for the DIA 2015 Euro Meetings Medical Devices and Combination Products theme, and I'm thrilled to have this opportunity to discuss this important topic with them and to share with our readership. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
If I might ask you the first question to you, Paul, you've mentioned on the YouTube webcast that we've had on the DIA website that there are, quote, a number of challenges that face the industry with regards to the biologics that go into these drug-device combinations and with regards to the health apps that are required to collect all of the information, end quote. Could you please explain a few of these challenges in some detail?
I'll do my best. It's hard to do in a few minutes, but let me talk first with regards to biologics. I think the essence is they're new. And by virtue of being new, many of the biologics are monoclonal antibodies, and therefore, by their very nature, tend to be very viscous. In fact, many are non-Newtonian, so they no longer behave the way we traditionally think of fluids behaving. So once you put that into a primary drug container, and then you put that container into a device creating this drug-device combination, you now have a whole new world that has to be understood in terms of how the system works. And it's those systems that are new, and from a regulatory perspective, require some different ways of thinking, different ways of evaluating, different ways of looking at the problems to make sure that at the end of the day we do what's right, and that is to produce a safe and efficacious drug device product. So I think from a biologic standpoint, that's the key that has to be understood. And many of the pipelines of large pharmaceutical companies and many of the startups are all biologics. I mean, the company that I work for, we have a pipeline that's more than 75% biologics. So there's a huge groundswell of new products that are coming along, and they can't be made into pills and capsules, so they have to be brought into the body other ways. Traditionally through needles, but you can't push a thick liquid through a needle. So then what do? The other problem you have with these biologics and with the whole timing from a development standpoint is many people would like to get into clinical trials as fast as possible. The easiest way to do that would be to use a prefilled syringe. The problem is the regulators rightfully are saying, we'd like to, for purposes of human factors and usability, make sure that you use the to-be-marketed device. There's a conflict there because you can't get the to-be-marketed device designed because sometimes you don't know what the formulation of these biologics are. You don't know how viscous, you don't know the volume, and therefore, when you're trying to develop these devices, you either have to wait a long period of time at enormous cost, or you have to proceed with a prefilled syringe, and then you have to negotiate with the regulators for some kind of a bridging study. And that's another new area for them in terms of how do we create these bridging studies. And then I guess the third part around biologics is just the simple fact that people still don't like injections. You know, we have a compound right now that we're that's being evaluated that has replaces what was once a pill with a once every 2 week injection. So now you have to convince patients who were previously popping a pill every day that they have a better drug if they take an injection every 2 weeks. So there's a lot of factors going on, and that's why I made the statements I did around the challenges with the biologics. With regards to the health apps, again, I think, and people who come to our session tomorrow will hear this, what is a medical device app? It's a fascinating world because you don't know when should it be regulated, when shouldn't it be regulated. So I know that we're learning together with the regulators as to how do we properly, fairly, and appropriately evaluate these apps so that we make sure that we don't slow things down, but at the same time we don't put something out in the marketplace that creates a hazard for patients.
Very interesting, and lots of areas for discussion, debate, and further development. What, in your opinion, is the next big step that needs to take place in this area to make sure that patients get the medicines they need and using these devices appropriately?
Well, I think that the biggest, let me say it this way, the low-hanging fruit is probably in the health apps, because I'm absolutely convinced that every device that we manufacture in the future needs to be connectable. And the most obvious way to gather the data will be through some kind of app on a smartphone. And it doesn't matter what brand, they'll be all ubiquitous. We'll just be able to grab the information and then do something with it. So I think that knowing how to capture the data and how to appropriately regulate it is the low-hanging fruit, but the area that needs the most attention in the coming years ahead.
Very exciting. Will the Apple Watch be one of those connected devices that you are thinking of, perhaps?
Yeah, we're looking at nanotechnology that, for example, would miniaturize a blood glucose meter so small that we can inject it through a needle. It would last 6 months to 12 months, and then you would just get a continuous signal. I could easily imagine the Apple Watch or technology like that gathering the data and then sending it to the iPhone and then to the cloud. And that's probably the way it'll go.
Well, thank you. Sabina, may I ask you a question? Are there any anticipated points of controversy in the forthcoming European medical device regulation and in vitro diagnostic regulation? If so, what are they? If not, what are these regulations anticipated to include or to not include?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and if I answer it, I will start from how the medical device directive in Europe is shaped now, and that is done by a regulatory technique that is called new approach, but the new approach already dates from the 80s of the last century. And in essential, it comes to this, that in the legislation you only have the real essential requirements, and the technical requirements are kept out of the regulations, and they are filled in by what we call standards. And a standard is written by all stakeholders, and that is the basis of the system. So the essentials in the law and the technical specifications somewhere else. And this system worked quite well for almost 3 decades, but there was a need for modernization. And that process of modernization was already going on. And then there was a scandal, which was called the PIP breast implants, where a fraudulent manufacturer used a technical grade of silicone oil in breast implants instead of a medical one. And this was really a case of fraud, but that had its repercussions on the drafting process of the legislation. And there are some provisions, because this PIP scandal was really a scandal, and it has its shadows on the legislation, and some of the provisions which come from this PIP scandal, you can question whether they are proportionate and whether they are answering the questions which are raised by the PIP scandal. And one of the main points, there are more, of controversy, is what they call the scrutiny provision. Apart from the system with the essentials in the legislation and then the technical specs in the standards, there's also a system that not the government as such approves a medical device, but this is more or less delegated to what we call notified bodies. And that's the whole system, and the notified bodies are controlled by the competent authority. So it's a stepwise system, in contrast with pharmaceuticals, where you have a direct approval from the competent authorities. So this two-layered system is, well, it worked very well, but now they said, well, that's okay, but we need something on top of this system. And they have built a second layer of approval, which is called a scrutiny. And it seems to be limited to high-level devices, to high-risk devices, but we don't know that yet. And this is a point of controversy, because you have one system and then you put a second system on top of it. And will that help the European patients, yes or no?
So that is a question in your mind, yes, to which it's impossible to give an answer at this time?
Yeah, because the proposal of the European Commission is on the table. The Parliament has said what they want, and the Parliament really wants to have a strong scrutiny, and they want to build another system with separate experts approved by the EMA, the European Medicines Agency. So there is a whole... They want to expand this system, and the council, the third party who can say what they want, have not made up their mind. But this is one of the points where there is much controversy in council. Do you need a second system on top of the existing system, yes or no? So,
is there a concern that this would add to the bureaucratic burden and perhaps,
yes,
the timeline to approvals and licensing?
Timelines, and also there has been some criticism in the original commission proposal. It was a little bit pick or choose, and then you get legal uncertainty whether your product is chosen for this scrutiny, yes or no, and you don't know that in advance. I think that has been mitigated, but yeah, well, as I said, Council has not come up with a formal position, so we don't know. But this is an area of concern.
Let me ask you both about the area of precision medicine, which increasingly is going to require the use of companion diagnostics. Is the European system, however you wish to define it, prepared to cope with the scientific advances that will give us more precise medicines that in many cases will require companion diagnostics? Will patients be able to have access to exciting new precise medicines and their companion diagnostics in timely fashion? Or are there going to be bureaucratic or regulatory roadblocks, reimbursement roadblocks between, you know, discovery and patient?
Yeah, okay. Well, here you point to a fundamental problem, because companion diagnostics accompany a pharmaceutical, but the diagnostics as such are regulated as in vitro diagnostics. And so the problem, well, I can't answer your question about the points of concern about the in vitro diagnostics regulation, but this will work, but the problem is that then the diagnostic has to be registered together with the pharmaceutical. And you could, if there are developments that maybe the manufacturer wants to change the biomarker or wants to change the diagnostics, that will be very hard to achieve in the current system. So the basic problem here is that the two systems are not aligned. The in vitro diagnostic regulation is updated as well, as is the medical device regulation. And there are two major changes. One is that they have changed the classification. It used to be a list-based classification, and now they have a risk classification, which really stratifies the diagnostics in the severer the consequences for the patient if the diagnosis is not correct, the higher the risk classification. So that is changed, and that will cause a lot of in vitro diagnostics who are currently self-declaration by the manufacturer that they have to go via the notified body. And the other thing is that there is an extra requirement for in vitro diagnostics that they have to prove clinical performance. And what is clinical performance for a diagnostic? That's the debate on that has not been ended yet. But that is a requirement that is in the proposals.
I mean, Paul? From my perspective, I'll put the dreaming aspect on it. Because on one hand, what Sabina's given you is what I think is the reality of the situation the way it is today. I'd like to think that as we get to more precise medicine and we start to combine diagnostics and delivery of more personalized medication to patients, that the regulators will start to take a different view of this. Right now, if you think about it, when they approve a particular drug, it's typically for the masses. It's for millions of people. If you start thinking about an individualized therapy, I think that the agencies will start to say to themselves, let's understand the risk. Let's make sure the patients have all the data so that they and their healthcare provider can make informed decisions. But I'd like to then think that they would allow the patients to accept the risk or not accept the risk, depending upon what they believe are the benefits. Because if their life is so miserable for whatever disease state they have, and they believe they can be treated, even though they know what some of the side effects are, I think they should be given that choice. I mean, it comes back down to an individual choice. So if it's only in this more precise and more personalized way, I actually would like to think that that's a way in which we can get around some of the problems that we have right now. But that's not to take away from what Sabina said. It's a very real problem today. And if you try to make a companion diagnostic that's going to apply to, you know, all children under the age of 16, it's going to be much harder than if it's just for Alberto and his oncology treatment.
Would you say that the adaptive licensing scheme that EMA has been piloting speaks to this? In other words, making a drug and possibly a companion diagnostics available to a well-defined, more limited number and type of patient prior to general licensing and general availability?
Yeah, I believe that's on the right path. I mean, that's where it's headed, in my view. Now, I'm not an expert in that area. Sabina probably knows a lot more about that than I do. I believe that that's in the right path and in the right direction, and I think that's where we need to go.
Great. In closing, are there any big messages arising from your theme, from the various sessions in your theme, that you think our readers and the wider audience of the AA should know? Anything we haven't touched on?
Well, I guess I would like to say, often I think we believe that everybody who is worrying both from the manufacturer side and from the regulatory side and from the government side, that they understand the problems. I don't think that we do. I mean, I'm often surprised when I talk to people that they're still uncovering all the various nuances and problems of this new and emerging area of these drug device combinations and it, with biologics and health apps and number of the other areas that we're talking about in our theme. So I'd like to think that all of the people who participate and attend will walk away with a greater understanding, a greater knowledge, so that they can then contemplate the problem and come up with better solutions.
Right. Sabina, any final thoughts?
I couldn't agree more. Originally coming from the pharmaceutical world and now quite active in the medical device field, it is sometimes as if people speak a different language. And forums like this help to overcome that differences in language or in interpretation. So I was very pleased this morning being in that the room was so full of people wanting to hear about what was happening with the medical device regulations in Europe. So I think this is a very useful forum.
Was there a particular aha moment in the various audiences that you've detected, people coming to a sudden epiphany and making a realization that changed their way of thinking? Did you notice anything like that?
I can't say that I heard it today in our theme, but I heard it yesterday in the keynote, and one of the speakers said, because there was often this belief that we should have one approval system and that if you get a compound or a drug device combination approved in country A, it should be global. And someone pointed out, and for me that was an aha moment, which was if you take away competition, you'll get bad decisions over time. I think that's very profound, and that helps me understand a little bit better why there's a value in having some, you know, multiple reviews. Now, maybe we don't have to have 130 reviews, but some multiplicity is probably good.
Yeah, it was an aha moment, but also I realized that we are not at that point yet. We could do better with, well, you say 131, but maybe we need two or three,
yes,
and that will be enough.
Yeah.
So we are not at that point yet. But
exactly. Yeah.
Some number between 1 and 200.
Yeah, but more into the direction of not
more
one.
More in single-digit numbers
would be fine.
Great. Well, thank you both for taking the time today for this important discussion. This concludes our podcast for today. To learn more about this topic or to read the current issue of DIA's Global Forum, please visit www.diaglobal.org. Thank you.